This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I am Katie Rich, and I'm here to tell you all about the interview you're about to hear, which I did with Adam Sandler. You know who Adam Sandler is. But on this occasion, we were talking about his movie Hustle, which came out on Netflix earlier this year. I watched it as someone who doesn't know all that much about basketball, doesn't know that much about, you know, Adam Sandler movies, beyond that he's been very famous my whole life. And I was just completely bowled over by it. It is a sports movie. Really, I've been recommending it as a movie for anyone who loves a training montage. This has a really good one. It's directed by Jeremiah Zagar, who had a movie called We the Animals a few years ago. And it's this really heartfelt, funny, kind of in some ways quintessentially Adam Sandler movie where he's playing this guy who he was kind of down on his luck and he's trying hard. He's an NBA scout who's trying to make his way up to coaching. And he kind of hitches his wagon to this Spanish potential breakout star, Bo Cruz, played by a real NBA star. There's a lot of real NBA stars in the movie, which you might know. I didn't know because I didn't recognize them because I don't know anything about the NBA, but that did not stop me from enjoying the movie. And I loved talking to him so much. You know, Adam Sandler had this huge run with Uncut Gems back in 2019. At the start of the interview, I told him that I had seen him in person at our Oscar party in February 2020. Little did we know what was going to come after that. And I think it's really interesting not just to talk about Uncut Gems and the acclaim he got for that, but just how you figure out how to spend your days and what to do with your time when you have so much success like he does and have the ability to pick and choose your own projects, which not a lot of people do. So I thought he was really thoughtful about that, about getting out on the road to do stand-up and, you know, just figuring out what's next for him after the success of Hustle. So I really enjoyed it. I hope you do, too. Let's hear my conversation with Adam Sandler. How long has it been since you've been on tour?
Yeah, we were going to do the tour. Then the pandemic happened and we canceled the tour. We were literally doing shows, getting ready, and then I remember going, I don't think we can do this. We can't go out there, have people sit with each other and stuff. So we canceled the tour, and that was, how long ago was that? A couple of years ago.
Yeah, 2.5 years ago. I wanted to start by asking, because I saw you in person at the last party I went to for a long time at our Oscar party in 2020. You were there with the Safdies. And I was just, you know, that Uncut Gems process was kind of a whirlwind. And I wondered about the day after that, like when that party was over, when the Uncut Gems tour was over, like, what did you feel ready for? Where was your head at when that all wrapped up and you had to figure out what was next?
Boy, I just remember that whole process was fun, getting to know those guys, getting to be with those guys, it kind of felt like the old days, like early Saturday Night Live, hanging out with a group, going places together, believing in a project together. And I just felt like I had great teammates there. And I just remember it being nothing but exciting and fun and a great connection.
Did that change what you wanted to do next? Was you know, deciding to do a stand-up tour, partly coming off of Uncut Gems and saying, hey, now that I've done this, I want to go in this direction?
I think it all always goes like that. It's whatever you're feeling in a moment, you enjoy that moment, and then you say, what can I do to, I mean, it doesn't happen every time, but you say, what can I do? What feels right next? What would I think is going to be exciting for me? What might be interesting to the audience? You try to mix things up and do stuff that makes you wake up and go, oh man, I gotta go crush this.
Yeah. Well, so then a month after that Oscar party, COVID hits, you're cancel a stand-up tour. Then what do you decide you want to do? Like, what is it like in that moment as you figure out how to, you know, keep working at all?
That was all just making, you know, like everyone else on the planet, just making sure the family was safe and everybody was good and friends and figuring out what life's going to be like. And then eventually as it started to progress, time was moving on and people were finding ways to work. I remember the movie Hustle. I think that came up, the script, the idea. And then I met Jeremiah Zagar, the director. We met because the Ted Sarandos from Netflix told me I should watch his movie.
Yeah.
And this movie, We the Animals, and I loved it. And I called him up to just tell him how much I loved it. And we were discussing stuff, and somehow we ended up talking about this Hustle movie. We started Zooming and jamming on stuff over Zoom every day.
Yeah. I think you said that Hustle came to you from LeBron James's company. So had you been talking to them before? Had you been trying to pursue something with his company before this one came up?
This all, like most of the stuff that I've been involved with, just luck. Luck. I got Joe Roth, who also worked with the movie and was partners with LeBron on this movie. They somehow thought of me and they sent it my way. And I loved it immediately. I loved the idea of behind the scenes basketball and getting to see hard work and I just a big fan of so many players and basketball, and it's been such a huge part of my life. So it was exciting.
Had a basketball movie been on your mind before that came in? You're such a big fan. Like, it must have been there somewhere, right?
Yeah. I've always, you know, I've involved basketball over the years in my comedies and stuff.
Yeah.
This was a different approach at it. And, you know, like when I did Uncut Gems and this was a jeweler, I was starting from scratch because I knew nothing about jewelry. And I had to do a lot of preparation and being comfortable and confident in knowing what, as much as I could know about that craft or that business. And basketball, I had a nice head start because I knew a lot of stories, a lot of stuff. I knew a lot of players over the years. I knew my history, not as much as like a super fan, but I'm pretty in there.
Yeah. So that Zoom process with Jeremiah and then everyone else, like, how did working on that stuff via Zoom feel for you? I mean, a lot of people hated transitioning to Zoom. Did it work okay for you guys? I mean, the movie turned out.
Well, I think it was exciting to just be working. I do remember I was in my house in a basement and my two daughters were doing school. And in this part of my house, there were no doors. So it was like, I had one daughter maybe 20 feet on the right, another daughter in a different area. Oh, yeah, maybe 20, 30 feet away from me on the left. And I was on Zoom quietly talking to Jeremiah a lot. And my kids were just like, stop talking so loud. And, Zoom school was going on while we were working on Hustle.
Yeah. I mean, that's like what everyone in the country was doing at the same time. We were all kind of evened out and sick of Zoom at that point.
Well, you know, it was interesting. It was new. I kept thinking, why was Zoom and what happened to Skype? How come Skype's not happening? Because I used to Skype all the time with Tim Hurley, a guy I write all our comedies with. I always would Skype with him, and we see each other and that kind of thing. And then the Zoom took over. And anytime I mentioned Skype to people, they'd say, like, no, we're going to Zoom. I'd be like, oh, all right, what? I feel bad for Skype right now.
No, it changed really fast, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you work a lot. Like, you know, looking back over the last couple of years, like you just, you know, you're producing things, you're acting in things. So is that period of not working, were you just like itching to get back on a movie set or get on tour? Did you have that drive to work as soon as possible?
I think like most people, it was like a forced break. And so you went, there was no guilt in this break. You had nothing saying like, I should be doing that. You're just like, I should be taking care of my family or making sure everybody's safe. So I didn't have that itch as much as you would think. I remember I did a few things early on. When Saturday Night Live came back on the air, Pete Davidson called me up and said he was doing a song. And so we did a verse in my house with my family. And they operated the cameras and stuff and shot a bunch of silly stuff. And that was fun to be working for a second. I swear to you, it was exactly what everyone on the planet was feeling. You just kind of sat back and said, let's just do what's best and safest.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
You've worked with, you know, your family and friends and people who are like not necessarily professional actors a lot before. And I was thinking about that watching Hustle because there's so many basketball players who are, you know, there's people playing themselves like Dr. J, but like people like Anthony Edwards, like giving performances who are not actors. And you're not the director, but I wondered if like if your experience bringing people on camera who haven't done it before, if you could, you know, help them out in any way and kind of help bring those performances out.
Jeremiah did most of that, but I'll tell you, when they were on a basketball court, the players were on a basketball court, they were in that mode. Yes, they're doing what we ask them to. We ask them to miss a shot. We ask them to steal the ball, blah, blah, blah. But when it came to being real and discussing life on the court or after a game, it was very, very, they were at ease. They would always... Something in the script, somebody might say, like, I wouldn't say that. We'd say, well, what would you say? And they would knock out exactly, you know, what they'd feel comfortable saying or what they thought was real. And that was such a mission we had with the movie because who was involved? All these all superstars, and LeBron and and the NBA was so involved that we just wanted to make sure that people in the NBA watched the movie and say, yeah, it's pretty much like that.
Yeah. I was thinking about Stanley Sugarman and the line of like losers that you've played on screen because they go back a long way. Like there's Uncut Gems, then going back to The Waterboy. And you had success pretty early in your career. And I wonder like if it's just that playing losers is fun or if there's some kind of like, you know, sliding doors like that could have been me to those characters that appeals to you.
That's a good question. I think I'm comfortable in that world. I'm comfortable. It's probably natural to me because I've been doing this a long time. I mean, I just went on stage last night. When I first walk on the stage, I never go like, all right, here I am. I'm always just like, well, what the hell am I doing here right now? I just have a natural part of my brain that feels like This is, I don't belong here. Why am I setting myself up like this? I don't think I should be, asking people to look at me right now. So anyways, I guess this feeling uncomfortable and loser kind of stuff I've been doing for years, it's in me.
And do you get done at the end of the day and you're just like, okay, thank God I can go back to, myself with my family and, the success that you have, you kind of get it out on the set?
I like being on a movie set. I like when I'm probably the most comfortable on a set outside of
more than on stage.
Stage, if it's rolling along and we're doing good, I feel great. In stand-up, you could be killing for 50 minutes and then all of a sudden make a wrong turn. And then the last 10 minutes of the show is like, whoa, what happened there? He kind of lost his mind. That still happens. You got to concentrate. You got to just ride it out, feel comfortable. And sometimes you veer off and all of a sudden you lose the audience and sometimes you luck into getting them back, and then sometimes you walk off stage going, wow, that hurt. That was a painful moment for everybody.
is that part of what brings you back, where you're like, okay, well, that didn't go right, but I can do it better next time? Like
you die. The nights you do poorly, you cannot wait to get introduced again somewhere else to make up for it, because you're like, I can't live with that one. I gotta let's end on a good one. And then when you have a super show, part of your brain is like, yeah, why am I doing tomorrow night, man? There's no way the show's going to go as good as that. And it doesn't. There's no way. You can't crush it perfectly. It's just some nights where your energy is great. The audience energy is great. It just connects. And then you go, let me try to duplicate that. And then that just never works out for you.
It's like gambling, right? You think you can stay on a hot streak.
That's very true. Yeah.
I was thinking about the audience because, you're back on tour. You've got the audience right in front of you, but you've made so many movies for Netflix where you know that people are watching it. You can get feedback, but you don't know how many people, no one's seeing it. Well, some people might see it in the crowd, but it's so different from even when you started making movies. Do you still get to think about your audience or get a sense of what people like, or do you have to change the way you think about your audience doing that?
That's good. I think of the audience. I've always think of who's watching it, and I always try to make sure that they can't guarantee it's working, but every time, but always think of them sitting, watching, discussing afterwards, saying what they liked, what they didn't like, what stuff lands. If we're watching a movie and there's a slow spot, we got to get past that quicker, or we got to find a way to get rid of that, or cut it differently, or that kind of thing. We're always thinking of the audience, and I always did throughout the making movies, that when people were sitting in the theaters more, and there was no, mm-hmm. you thought of the rhythm, the person watching, and how to keep them focused and laughing or just involved. But I feel like I watch my kids watching movies. I watch my wife watch a movie. I see when they're in the pocket, when they're deeply enthralled in something. And then I see what it's like when they all of a sudden tune out and say, yeah, I'm hungry and want to go in the other room. So you try to eliminate those moments.
Yeah. Did you get to see it? Because I know Hustle played in the theaters. Did you get to see that movie with an audience?
Yeah. We
that
always
must have felt great.
Oh, my God. The premiere they had was kind of like the old days. It was at a theater that I had a lot of premieres in the 90s. It was in Westwood. It was massive premiere. It was like a couple of thousand people watching the movie. A lot of NBA guys were there. A lot of just normal people showed up, and they were getting to sit in the theater with these superstar dudes around, and it was just a good energy. And the movie kind of played like a Rocky kind of feel, where you got excited in moments and you were pulling for Bo Cruz, and it was quite an energy. And it was, you could only have that in a movie theater with a group of people. It was tremendous.
Yeah, any movie with a training montage that good, like, you're going to get a crowd response.
That was a long-ass training montage that my editor guys cut together with with Jeremiah, and it was awesome. It was awesome. Just he worked his ass off, Juancho. He just every day was running, lifting weights, and by the end of some days, he was like, "What are you doing to me, man? Why am I wearing construction boots while running all, you know, basketball?"
Well, even you, like the way the movie's put together, like you're doing the montage of like going to the hotel rooms. Like it's a lot of doing the same thing over and over again. Like that's asking a lot of you too, not running up a hill.
What I love a lot about my character, it was the stuff like the showing up at 4 a.m. and picking up Juancho to get to push him and push him and push him. And it reminded me a lot of my father, whose name was Stanley, also a named the character after him. He was, I don't think there was one time in my life that he mentioned he was tired. He just would just go, whatever time it was, my pop was up, he was ready. My mom was up with him making breakfast for everybody. And it just reminded me of what this family in the movie was just like all in, no talking about, hey, I'm sacrificing too. And it was just more like, let's get you to be the best you can be. And that's what my character was doing for Bo Cruz. And that's what my parents always did for me.
I feel like you just gave me the answer to the question, like, why do you work so much all the time? It's like your parents worked all the time. So you do too.
They, you know, it's funny. They weren't, my father would tell me, you got to enjoy this a little bit more too. Sit back, relax, let other people handle that stuff. When we did 50 First Dates and my father was sick, he was in the hospital, and me and my wife were in the hospital every day with him at Mass General. And I was getting these tapes from the 50 First Dates editing room and showing me cuts and stuff like that. And I would look at it and I'd show my dad. He'd be like, "That's good. That was good." He'd say, "See, they can do it without you, man. They can do it. I can just enjoy a little bit more instead of thinking you got to be there and this and that." I was like, "Yeah, but I thought maybe it might be funnier if this happened." See, and he'd be like, "Yeah, maybe. Or maybe you could just sit back and relax and let other people have some fun too." And so my father was kind of like pushing me to calm down, not work so much. And I think I have calmed down a lot. My wife always brings that up, that I spend a lot more time on the weekends with the family and stuff. In the year when I first was with my wife, she was just like, "This guy's bananas. I'm hanging out with him in recording studios every weekend and making comedy records. And I would do a movie into a album and into whatever I could do to just try to kick ass."
And so you still work a lot, but you feel like it's less of like a frantic thing. Like you feel like you can sit still a little bit more.
I think I'm much better at my office is down the street from my house. I just go out of nowhere, just go, "All right, I'm going to go home." And Joel kind of looks at me like, "What happened? He's going home?" And then I go home, and then I'm home, and I'm hanging out, and I'm doing my stuff with my wife and the kids. And then I notice they kind of ignore me for 20 minutes straight. And I go, "All right, maybe I'll go back to work and kick some ass." And then I'll get back home for some other stuff.
I think it's interesting when people are in a position in Hollywood to be able to choose what they do, because you will know that it's, you know, not a lot of people get to do that. So when something comes to you, if it's script or someone to work with, what kind of makes you say, "Oh, yeah, that's the thing"? Like, you have limited time. You decide to spend that on it. Do you know what it is that makes you say, "Yeah, that's for me"?
Yeah. Who's involved with it? If I connect to a subject matter, if I feel a little like I'm not sure how I'm going to go after that, that's probably a good sign that nervous about the particular project. It's like I'm going to do a movie with the Safdie brothers, and we're supposed to start in the late winter, right? So part of my brain right now is like, I'm on tour. Then once that Safdie brothers movie starts, and I love those guys, I know we're going to dedicate ourselves into working our asses off and making sure it's as good as it can be. And I know that takes a lot of time. So part of my brain's going, "Whoa, once that movie starts, I'm in deep. Yeah. My life's going to change." And it's like everybody, when you work hard, you're tired, you're knocked out. Some parts of your life you miss out on some stuff that you wish you could have seen. But ultimately, I know it's going to be a few months of going after a goal that we all feel the same about. We want to do the best we can.
Is that you? So you expect that to be as intense as making Uncut Gems?
Yeah, because of how much these guys care and how much I don't want to let them down. And I see how hard they work. And just like when I'm working on my comedies with my friends, it means a lot to us. Every joke means a lot. The Safdie boys, every word means a lot to them. Every frame of the movie means a lot. So I won't walk through anything for them, just because out of I care about it and I respect those guys so much.
Yeah. So you were talking about your teenage daughters, and I was thinking about the NBA players who were in this movie who are young guys. Like, to be in the NBA, you have to be on the younger side. And I was curious about how much you try to, like, keep up with what teenagers and younger people are, like, what TikTok is doing, what comedy is. Like, I think about this a lot getting into my late 30s. Like, how much do I need to know about this? And I wondered if making Hustle brought this up for you in terms of what these basketball players who are younger than you are talking about or into.
I love watching those guys, my kids, with their friends, what they're talking about. I kind of sit back and hear it. I'm not deep in it. I don't really know. I mean, I will, to be honest, even when they Snapchat, I'm not sure what's going on. I'm pretty bad. Like Judd Apatow, he knows literally everything with this whole social media shit. And I watch him talk about it. I'm like, all right, Judd's, he's involved with that shit. He's having a good time. I don't know. I should know more for many reasons, but I kind of just enjoy hearing everyone else do it. The NBA guys, they were all just nice people. So we got close in conversations, but sure, they know different world, and my kids know a different world than I do. And then when I walk into a room in my house and they're watching TV and they're all laughing, I'll look at the screen and be like, who's that? And they'll say who the person is, and I'll say, well, what do they do? Whatever show, a makeup show or this, or they're big on YouTube or whatever. I watch a few minutes. I go, oh yeah, I can see why you like that.
Because I feel like a lot of people get older and they're just like, oh, what the kids think is funny isn't funny anymore. And I think in comedy, it's really tricky to connect with an audience. But it sounds like what is funny now and what has changed, you are in line with, even if you can't keep up with.
I'm not as on top of it as, like I keep saying Apatow. He knows everything. Everybody always says, he mentions a show, he mentions a person. I always go, I didn't see that, man. I don't know that. But my kids clicking, my wife clicking with something at home, and never is a time where I watch that. I go, get out of here, that's crap. I always go, oh yeah, I get that. That's funny. Oh, I like that. You guys love that. My kids love. Holy cow, do they love Modern Family and The Goldbergs? It's bananas.
Like 10-year-old shows, like.
They click so much with those shows. I think it happened over the pandemic, and they still makes them feel good. They laugh their asses off, and they just like good family shows and comedy and full on comedy. And then, like I said, they like I don't know if it's YouTube or whatever it is. It's like those quick 3-minute kind of things you look at, or 10-minute kind of things, and. People who are superstars on the internet, my kids love that stuff, and they have conversations about them and talk about whatever, who's funny, makeup, who sings good, all that stuff. And I try to, I don't really know any names, but I do get involved and say, yeah, that's, she's cool, he's cool, they're funny, that I get it.
Do you think what you find funny has changed over the years, or has your personal sense of humor been pretty consistent?
I think it's all a little cooler, a little sharper out there. People know a lot more. I'm a little behind on technology kind of jokes and stuff about the new way of life and talking, and I don't know the vernacular as good as I as a lot of people do, but
no, that's for other people. You do what you find funny.
I do, yeah, no, but I haven't seen any new comedy that I go, no way, man, that's ridiculous. I like it all. I've watched Saturday Night Live this Saturday. I loved it. I loved a lot of skits. There's a more and more stuff going on that's pretty ridiculous to watch, and I'm a fan of lots of styles.
When you look back at, like, I mean, not even just your comedy, I was thinking about your acting too. Like, when, you know, even before Billy Madison, like, do you recognize that actor and that person? Like, do you still feel like you're that same person, or do you feel the distance there?
I feel the same, in a way that I was always pretty excited to be doing it. I don't look back at any of my old stuff and go, whoa, you nailed it there, man. I'm usually like, wow, you were just getting by, man. You're lucky to do it. I think just getting more and more settled as a human being. So my acting's probably, changing over the years. And what I always thought I was doing the right thing in the moment, and I still do. But I look back at even stuff from 5 years ago, I go, oh, should have done this, man. That was a little weird choice that you made. man, what the hell happened? But that's probably the thing I look back at. Maybe I played it too big, or maybe I was too trying to show what I was feeling in that moment, or the joke was over the top, or whatever the hell it was. But then it meant a lot to me, and I believed in it then. So I still back it up.
So you wouldn't, like, you could go back and, like, cut all your old movies, like Francis Ford Coppola, like, you wouldn't change it.
That takes a lot of, first of all, probably too lazy to ever think to do that. But I there was a process in every room we were in, and at every, on every set, every writing room. Me and my buddy and my buddies, we believed in what we presented. So no, I wouldn't change anything. I mean, stuff that I did that I look back at that could be hurtful, I'd be like, ah, shit, I wish I'd never said that. But that's not changing cuts because we thought it could be. I think it would be funnier. In that moment, we believed in it.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Maybe one last question for you, since we started talking about Uncut Gems. You're about to go work with the Safdies. What do you expect to feel like when that's over? Like, when you're done making that movie, do you know what you're going to do next? Do you know what you're going to want to do?
I'm not sure what I'm doing for myself. A movie that I create and help create with my friends. I don't know what that one is next. I have a couple of great things coming. Nothing is guaranteed in life, but I've been talking with Noah Baumbach. He has an awesome idea. I've been talking to Scott Cooper. He has an amazing script. I was talking to Todd Fields.
That's a wide range of people to be talking to all at once.
Yeah, all really, really amazing ideas and stuff. And then you figure out, we'll see what's actually going to happen. I hope they all do.
Yeah. Well, sorry, another question. But I heard you say on another interview that you've been friends with Todd Field for a long time. Have you seen Tar?
I didn't get to see it yet. No, but I'm reading this book right now that Todd sent me, and he gave me, and it's a long book. And I think Todd reads a lot quicker than me because I keep saying, I'm on chapter 9 now. He's like, good Lord, hurry up. But no, I hear Tar's amazing. He's a tremendous guy. I know that guy for when we were young, and he's one of the sweetest guys and funniest guys, and he's just he's certainly dedicated to making good stuff. Saw Tar?
Yeah, I saw Tar. I went to the New York Film Festival premiere. It was wild time. It's so good.
That's cool.
That guy spent 16 years between movies and came back with just something unreal. So. Yeah,
he's tremendous. He's tremendous for sure.
Yeah. Go see that and report back. I think you'll like it.
I will. I'm sure I will. I'm sure I got to see it on a big screen. He's not going to want me to see it on a little computer. So
yeah, God, when you're friends with filmmakers, they're never going to let you see it at home because they want it to
Oh, yeah,
be...
Paul Thomas Anderson. he shows me his movies all the time, and I couldn't get over to his house to see, I think it was
Licorice Pizza.
I couldn't get there because I had so much shit going on. I go, can you just send me it on Pix or a link or something? And he just wrote back, fuck you. I was like, all right, I know you care about the big screen.
That does it for today's interview episode. We'll all be back on Thursday with our regular roundtable episode. In the meantime, find us on Twitter at HWD. Find me on my own at Katie Rich, and find us at vanityfair.com. Our editor and producer, as always, is Brett Fuchs.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. They're sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.